Welcome to Parents' Perspective. Ken paid Mrs. Galinos and thanked her for babysitting Dougie for the evening. He closed the door and sprinted up to his son's room to check on his sleeping baby. "Honey, come quick!" Ken shouted to his wife, Megan. Megan arrived in the doorway to see her husband holding the limp six-month-old in his arms. "He won't move. He's just listless." Ken's voice was frantic. "And look at his eyes!" The baby's eyes were rolled back toward his forehead. They were glassy and half open. "I'm calling 911. Megan raced for her cell phone. The emergency medics stomped through the house and gently placed the baby on the rug. Ken and Megan hardly breathed as they watched the EMTs hovering over their son. In a few minutes, one of them approached the two. "We'll have to take him to the emergency room," he said gently. "It looks like shaken baby syndrome." Ken and Megan looked at each other. "Mrs. Galinos?" they gasped simultaneously. From a parent's perspective, what should we know about new medical information on shaken baby syndrome? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest has had experience with this kind of issue and with families who have faced it. Dr. Ronald Yasinski is a neurosurgeon on the faculty of the medical schools of George Washington University and Georgetown University. He's also the father of three grown sons and a daughter. Welcome to Parents' Perspective, Dr. Yasinski.
Well, thank you.
What is most commonly misunderstood about shaken baby syndrome?
The title evokes a very strong response, a visceral response. And if you ask people on the surface, what is it, people will describe something to you. And the vision is of a baby being grasped by the torso and vigorously shaken back and forth. It's a violent and a very graphic depiction. And it has come to be associated with what is described as a very specific act of abuse that's universally recognized. Everybody knows about it, but that's part of the problem. Because when you dig a little deeper, you find that person A knows about it because they read about it somewhere. Person B knows about it because person C told them. And when you trace it all the way back, there's not a whole lot of substance behind it. In fact, there really isn't any.
That's kind of scary.
Yes.
Would you provide us with a definition so that we can go forward knowing exactly what
it is? Well,
I'll
try to. As classically described, this so-called shaken baby syndrome is a condition in which babies suffer intracranial bleeding, specifically in the form of subdural hematomas, which is a collection of blood in a space referred to as the subdural space, bleeding in the back of the eyes called retinal hemorrhages, and originally fractures of the extremities, the long bones. But also associated with that, from time to time, you will see labeled fractures of the ribs, evidence of oxygen deprivation to the brain, and many other types of injuries that occur, maybe anecdotally, injuries to the liver, etc. The classical, originally understood, quote, triad, unquote, three symptoms, subdural hematoma, three findings, subdural hematomas, retinal hemorrhages, and fractures of the extremities.
Well, these things have to happen as a result of some kind of treatment of the child, obviously. Or do they?
They happen because of some kind of trauma.
Mm-hmm.
But injuries don't have labels. If I'm walking at a construction site and a brick happens to fall on my head, you can't tell from examining the injury on my head whether that brick was inadvertently knocked off a scaffold by a construction worker because he pivoted to talk to someone and his heel knocked the brick off the scaffold, or somebody was laying in wait for me and dropped a brick on my head. The injuries are the same. They don't imply who done it, just that it happened. And that's a key point to understand. Injuries are injuries. They don't have labels.
So what happens in cases where children arrive in an emergency room and are labeled as shaken babies?
Well, under those circumstances, a process starts. And once the presumption has been made that this is an inflicted injury, shaking, an investigation starts. And the focus shifts very subtly from what happened to who did it. And that becomes problematic.
What is it about the science behind all of this that led you to go on the course that you took?
Science is science, and it doesn't change. The sun and the earth are sitting there. Well, the earth didn't start revolving around the sun when we found out that it did. It was doing it since the beginning of time. So you see, the science doesn't really change. It's our understanding of what's happening in the world around us that hopefully matures. And speaking from personal experience, I have a background in neurosurgery, including pediatric neurosurgery. And I had occasion during one period where I did the pediatric neurosurgery for one of the universities here. And I think maybe about a half dozen or so cases of supposed shaken baby syndrome were referred during that period of time. And I noticed something. And what I noticed was there was always a better explanation for the injuries that the child had than shaking. For instance, there was one episode and a baby fell off a changing table, I think. And well, that was the history that the parents gave. And baby had a little skull fracture and some scalp swelling. And one of the pediatricians said, well, you don't get that kind of an injury from falling off a changing table. And I said, well, you do. And he said, no, the baby was shaken. And I said, well, go to your refrigerator tonight, take out an egg and shake it as hard as you can. No matter how hard you shake it, you're not going to crack the shell. You have to have an impact. And parents are telling me there was an impact. Baby hit its head. What they're saying actually makes more sense. So there was that story. And then there was another one where a baby was admitted with what's called a chronic subdural hematoma, which is an old injury. It's a subdural hematoma, but it's not fresh. It's old. And the history that the parents gave was actually pretty good for a baby with a chronic subdural. Baby had been sick for weeks, and she had taken him to the pediatrician, and he was diagnosed initially, I think, as having an ear infection, and he was vomiting and had gastroenteritis. And finally, I think somebody measured his head circumference, and his head was getting big a little too quickly, and so they referred him to a neurologist who did a CT scan and found the subdural, and the wheel started turning. The mother was actually describing a pretty good history, but the assumption was that this was a subdural hematoma that was caused by shaking. It wasn't. It was an old injury. And one of the problems here is that this chronic subdural hematoma is something that originally started weeks or months earlier, but the nature of the injury was such that it was either overlooked or missed entirely because it's not a big injury, but it didn't heal right. And because it didn't heal right, paradoxically, instead of going away, this collection of blood actually increased in size. But there are accommodating mechanisms for people with chronic subdurals, both adults and children, for different reasons. And eventually it came to clinical attention, but it was a time far removed from the injury.
Why do you think people are so quick to jump on this other bandwagon then?
There are several factors that tie into it, including the mandated reporting laws, which start out with very good intentions. If you suspect child abuse, you have to report it. But once that happens, you engage this apparatus that starts. And once that happens, even with the best of intentions, people start looking around for who done it rather than what happened.
When a person, say a babysitter, a caregiver of some sort, is blamed for this, what happens to that person?
Well, if they're convicted, they get punished. They either go to jail or something else happens with them, and that stays with them for life. They lose family, lose work. Their lives have changed. But, you know, even if they're not convicted, they live with this suspicion. Mm-hmm. And they can be put on a list of potential child abusers at the will of whatever Department of Child Protective Services is involved. And it's very difficult to get off that list once you're on it.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on revisiting the issues in shaken baby syndrome.
The popular book, Raising a Successful Child, Discover and Nurture Your Child's Talents, by Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents' Perspective. We are talking with Dr. Ronald Yusinski about revisiting shaken baby syndrome. What about parents whose children have been identified as having shaken baby syndrome, rightly or wrongly? What are they supposed to do?
You mean if something that's just happened and the spotlight is on an individual, parents or caregiver or what?
Yeah, and then parents are told this looks like shaken baby syndrome.
Then what?
They're in a very difficult situation right there because now the focus is on them, and often they don't even realize it. And they may be trying to cooperate with Child Protective Services or the physicians or even the police. And inadvertently, all too often what happens is that what they're saying gets used against them and a case is being built. The first thing to do is take a breath and calm down and try to step outside yourself. And the most important thing to do is to speak the truth. Tell whoever's asking you what you saw happen as precisely as you can. And if you're not sure and you don't know, then say, I'm not sure or I don't know. Everybody has good intentions. You know, people are trying to get at what happened. Sometimes, though, they're trying to get through the filter of identifying a perpetrator, which discolors things. The truth is the most important thing. If you do get accused and you get accused based on non-science, somebody's going to come to your defense. And the more truthful you are, the easier it's going to be to defend. One of the things that the child protection people concentrate on is an inconsistent history. You know, you keep changing your history. They identify that as somebody is lying or covering up. Well, you know, often what happens is people aren't really sure. So they'll say one thing one time, well, maybe it wasn't that way and maybe it was this way. And you don't want to get caught in that trap. If you don't know, you don't know. And that really is the truth, and that's all you can say. For better or worse, the truth is the best weapon that you've got. An additional point, when confronted with the possibility that you as an individual, whether a parent or a caregiver, may be under suspicion of child abuse, you have to think about getting a hold of an attorney. I hate to say it, but it's really an important point because you have rights. You were supposed to be presumed innocent until proven guilty, not the other way around. And these rights need to be protected, and an attorney can help you do that.
If a child has been shaken, is that like because of anger or annoyance on the part of the adult who's done the shaking? You know, like they can't quiet the child down or they can't get the child to do what they're wanting the child to do?
Well, think about that for a minute. The fact that you would ask that question shows how prevalent this notion of being shaken is. You ever seen anybody actually shake a child?
No, I haven't.
See? Has there ever been an actual witnessed event of a child that was shaken viciously enough to give it an injury? There's none that's recorded that I'm aware of. Oh.
So how did this start? This sounds like a rumor that began and then began to be accepted as fact.
That's exactly right.
A dangerous one.
You've actually said it. And it's funny you should have me here today because I inadvertently, I can't say I've been part of this, but I've been party to some of it. The original hypothesis, and it is a hypothesis, not proved, of injuring a baby by shaking it was proposed in 1971. And when it was proposed, the hypothesis stood and was almost immediately accepted as if it were settled science. And people jumped on the bandwagon and said, oh, yes, well, I've got six cases like this, and I've got five cases. Somebody else, I've got a bunch of cases like this, and this person reports that. But this is all anecdotal experience. Anecdotal experience is not true science. I mean, I could convince you anecdotally that the earth is flat. The ground we're on here is flat. You know, a calm day on any ocean is flat. The Serengeti Plain is flat. You put all that together, haven't we just shown all these places on the earth is flat? Therefore, isn't the earth flat? No, it's not. And if you really want to do an experiment, you got to get outside the earth, look back down, take a bunch of photographs from different angles. That's how you find out. And you find out it's not flat. But even with that, there are little facts here and there that if you're really perceptive would make you wonder if the earth is flat. For instance, you have the North Star. And at every point in the northern hemisphere, you can see the North Star. But the farther and farther away you get towards the equator, the closer it gets toward the horizon. But if the earth were really flat and you're on one surface, it should be visible all over the planet. But it's not. So you've got these little facts that will not go away. And no matter how you look at them, they're not going to change. And if you want to make the presumption that the earth is flat, you got to explain those facts, and you can't explain them. Therefore, you've got to go back and question your original assumption.
When someone leaves a child with, say, a daycare program and comes back to pick up the child and sees that the child is not his or her normal self the rest of that evening, bedtime, whatever, what happens? I assume they question what went on at the during the day.
Sure. You have a child who's off at a daycare center, and you take it back, and the baby's not acting right. Did it catch the flu?
Mm-hmm.
You know, is it anybody's fault? was the incubation period actually a day or so longer and the baby was exposed to something the day before? You don't really know. If your index of concern about, I don't want to say suspicion, but concern about your child is high enough, go see a doctor. You know, check in with an emergency room. And to get back to this point that you had raised earlier, the mechanical justification for causing subdural hematomas specifically in babies by shaking was all referenced as one single experiment that was done by a neurosurgeon right here in Washington for a totally different reason. And without getting into the details of the experiment, this particular neurosurgeon, in a crude experiment that was done working with the Department of Transportation concerned with automotive safety, was able to cause intracranial injury in animals, monkeys, by smacking the back of a chair that these monkeys were strapped into, and the chair was on wheels and the wheels were on tracks, with a piston, and causing a violent forward moving and having the head snap back and forth. He was really looking at whiplash injuries, but he found some intracranial injuries too. So the concept of a primate, let's say, because it was a monkey and we're talking about humans, having the head accelerated violently back and forth by a whiplash type of motion was picked up on qualitatively. I mean, this could happen. But quantitatively, whether or not humans could actually do this, didn't seem to bother the people. That experiment was never done. So it's like taking a major league pitcher and saying, this guy's got a great fastball. Boy, if he could throw that ball fast enough, he could hit the moon. Well, yeah, fine. If you could throw a fastball hard enough, maybe you could hit the moon. There's only one problem. A major league fastball will throw a ball at about 100 miles an hour. Escape velocity is over 20,000 miles an hour. So you're talking about several orders of magnitude. No human can throw a ball that fast. And if you did, what would happen to your arm? So this data, this quantitative information was never there. Qualitatively, the concept. Quantitatively, the fine print, if you want. Not there.
When parents turn up in a doctor's office or an emergency room with a child who they say must have been injured in some way, or that's what they're supposing, what kind of a medical approach do you and other doctors advocate from that point? Do you immediately begin to look for older injuries? What kinds of things are sought?
The question I ask myself, and I think the question that a doctor should ask him or herself is, what happened? You know, what's going on here? You leave the whodunit for later. First, figure out what happened. And don't make any assumptions. You have to be as objective as you can about it. And the more factual information you can get, the better. And, this is in medicine, what we're trained to do when we become physicians is take as accurate a history as we can and do a good physical. And we have a saying in medicine, you most of the time make the diagnosis in the history. In fact, it was a very famous physician named William Osler. One of his famous sayings was, listen to the patient, they're giving you the diagnosis. You pay attention to the patient and you'll figure out what's going on. And often with a baby like this, things may happen quickly. And you don't exactly understand what's going on, but you observe, the parent, caregiver, whatever, observes as best they can. And often when I've reviewed medical records in cases like this, there is very little information to go on, but more often than not, the information the caregiver is giving at the time is pretty reasonable and entirely consistent with some of the injuries that I find.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on revisiting the issues in shaken baby syndrome. Parents' perspective needs you, your feedback, your opinions, and not least, your donations that help with the cost of producing this award-winning program.
Visit us online at www.parentsperspective.org and click on to Give Direct, I Give, or eBay at Mission Fish. Please help us continue to help you. Thank you.
Welcome back to Parents' Perspective. We're talking with Dr. Ronald Yusinski to revisit shaken baby syndrome issues.
What does your medical approach now mean for caregivers and babies going forward?
Who knows? It isn't a new medical approach, actually, though. It's actually ancient. the importance of taking a history is, you know, goes back to probably the beginnings of speech and trying to find out why people get sick or how they get sick. I don't know what it means. All I can hope for is that it brings a certain element of objectivity and impartiality that is needed.
This triad of symptoms that you mentioned earlier that people usually hang diagnoses on, what does that represent in terms of the complications for the injured child?
Well, they can be an entire gamut. They can be very mild or none, or they can be very severe, even fatal. For instance, a subdural hematoma may be present anatomically, and it may be very large. Well, one of the fundamental guiding principles of neurological surgery, especially surgery of the central nervous system, which is the brain and spinal cord, is that they're unique among all other organ systems in the body because they're completely encased in bone. So if something gets in there and starts expanding quickly and a lot, the brain begins to be pushed aside, and it doesn't tolerate that very well, and you get sick. But there are other effects, too. The presence of an irritating factor alongside the brain may cause misfiring of neurons, and you get chaos that way, and you can have a convulsion. You have a convulsion, you obstruct your airway, or you have a convulsion and vomit and obstruct your airway. Well, the brain's got an absolute metabolic requirement for oxygen, and if you deprive it of oxygen for more than 4 or maybe 5 minutes, cells start to die, which is the ABCs of CPR, airway, breathing, and circulation. You clear the airway. So there are many different paths that these kinds of injuries can go. Some may be innocuous, and some may not be so innocuous. It depends on the individual characteristics of that particular person with that disease at that time.
So we have some children alive and living
well,
today
and
who are okay.
Mm-hmm. And some alive and really impaired, and some not alive.
In looking at the human brain in a newborn, is the birth process different for human beings from that in other primates?
Yes, it is. The human brain is a unique structure in the world, and not just the primate world, but the world. It's disproportionately larger. And because it is, and it probably as a factor of our own evolution, the birth process in humans is different and a little riskier. We don't get head control until we're 4 months old. And that was a striking feature to me because most other non-human primates are born with head control. And I didn't know this at the time until I saw a picture one day. But I began looking into it. And that's when I was able to learn about the uniqueness of the human birth process. When the pre-human ancestor became erect, the configuration of the pelvis changed and the inlet through which babies pass got smaller. But that freed up our upper extremities. But we can do enormous things with our upper extremities, you know, hold coffee cups, do brain surgery, play musical instruments. You need a big neural processing unit to do this, so the brain's getting bigger. Then we have all kinds of communication. We talk, we sing, we write, we draw, we paint. You need a gigantic processing unit to do that. We think in the abstract, big processing unit. So you have a problem. You've got a big brain and a small pelvis, and nature solved this in some unique ways. But there's a price, and the price is that it hurts you, and the baby gets traumatized when it's born, and the head gets distorted, and you can have bleeding inside the head when you're born. And we're just beginning to learn this, even in an anecdotal sense right now. But when you think about it, it shouldn't be too surprising.
So babies can be born with issues that maybe don't come to light.
That's right.
Till later on, and sometimes that can be under the rubric of what we consider shaken babies.
That's exactly right. Intracranial bleeding in babies is probably a lot more common than has been suspected, and 5+ million years of human evolution has made a pretty effective cleanup system for that bleeding, but it's not perfect. And if it doesn't work, then the bleeding that may occur at birth goes undetected and may present clinically weeks or months later, and it looks like it's a new injury, but it's really not.
So how do you anticipate that the future of the shaken baby controversy will play out?
My hope is that the truth is going to prevail. You know, science is science, and it doesn't change. All you can hope for is that you keep putting the truth out there, and people figure it out.
Well, this is a conversation that could go on much longer, but unfortunately we have to close. But before we do, what resources, Dr. Yuzinski, would you suggest for our listeners who want to pursue some of these issues further?
I can give you two resources right at the outset, and they're polar opposites. This is great. So you go to them and you make up your own mind. The first one is the Shake and Baby website at www.don'tshake.org. And the other one is www.sbsdefense.org. Go to the website, look at them for yourselves, and make your own determinations. When you do, think as objectively as possible and try very carefully to differentiate what is opinion and what is fact. And to go from there, I'll give you two other references. And I've read both of these. The first one is a book called Wounded Innocence, and it's by an author named Richard Wexler, who I actually met and lives around here. And this really is an eye-opening book about child abuse, child protection, and is extremely thought-provoking. The other one has nothing to do with child abuse, and is called Scientific Method and Practice by Hugh Gauch, G-A-U-C-H, Cambridge University Press, 2005. And his thesis is that science really ought to be considered as a liberal art, and he goes along and explains why. Isaac Newton, for instance, was a natural philosopher. And the book came out because one of his graduate students wanted to know about the reasons for people thinking scientifically the way they do. How did scientific thought evolve to the point where it is today? And he realized that there's a difference between being a scientist and being a tradesman. Tradesman, you learn a trade. Science, you learn the thinking behind the trade.
Well, you have certainly given us a lot of thinking to do. So, Dr. Ronald Yuzinski, thank you so much for being with us today and helping us to unravel the mystery of shaken baby syndrome. Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of our book, Raising a Successful Child, Discover and Nurture Your Child's Talents. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. And please spell anything that's not obvious. That's a big help to us. Mention show number 485 and tell us, if you can, what station you're tuning into.
Visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org, where you can even listen to a show of your choice, or check us out at facebook.com/parentsperspective. This is Sandy Bird and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents Perspective. Today's program was made possible with generous support from you, our listeners. Our sound engineer is Kent Hitchcock. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.